Before looking at the primary texts, which will comprise our study of this segment of the Church as a Developing Institution, looking in particular at liturgies, particularly at liturgies of the Eucharist, and at ministries, before looking at the primary texts, I'd like to situate them historically with the aid of a couple of timelines and remind us of what we have already seen in earlier authors. We've already looked at the letters of Clement of Rome and Ignatius of Antioch, which provide us insight into church practice and experience at the end of the first and beginning of the second centuries. Clement of Rome writing at the very end of the first century, Ignatius of Antioch writing in the first decade of the second century. We're going to jump backward in time to look at the Didache, a church order which contains teaching, probably baptismal catechesis, and also descriptions of liturgical practice in the very early church. This document has been a source of controversy, as we shall see, since it was first found, and has been variously dated ever since it was discovered in the 19th century, but it's now pretty generally regarded as a witness to church practice in the latter part of the first century. So it is at least as old as, and maybe even older than, the letter of Clement of Rome, which we've looked at. So it may reflect church practice a little bit earlier than Clement's letter. So these three will remind us of things in the late first and the beginning of the second century. We'll be looking, as I said, particularly at the Didache, and then we will look at the Hippolytus apostolic tradition, which places us in a church context that is the beginning of the third century. So we'll be leaping ahead to a document which presents a vision of ministries that is better developed, that takes advantage of the full development of what happens during the second century and gives us a sense of what is going on at the beginning of the third century, the beginning of the 200s. Could we remind ourselves now and anticipate what we'll see? The Didache will provide a very primitive vision of the church, still recognizing itinerant, that is to say, traveling teachers and ministers who are referred to as apostles and teachers, probably a title of authority, not really meaning the 12 apostles, but people who are given that title who have not yet been, are not yet being described as local leaders, that is to say, overseers, which is the meaning of the word episkopos. However, in that document, the church, as we'll see, is encouraging people to appoint their own episkopoi, overseers, church leaders, as well as deacons, diakonoi. So there is a replacement, as we'll see, of this older, probably sub-apostolic model of apostles and teachers with locally appointed episkopoi, overseers, and servants, diakonoi. Then we've seen in the letters of Clement of Rome a description of those same two orders, now well established, and Clement adds the little tweak that he describes the episkopoi also as presbyteroi. The overseers are also described as elders. He doesn't distinguish between these church leaders. They seem to refer to the same individuals as we've seen, and he also describes the diakonoi, who are their assistants in ministry. Now, Ignatius, at the beginning of the second century, as we've seen, makes a clear distinction between three separate church orders. The single bishop, the episkopos, who is the leader, the overseer of the diocese, his immediate assistants, the presbyteroi, the presbyters, which literally means elders, and also the ministering deacons, the diakonoi. So Ignatius makes it clear that there is this threefold distinction of ministry and that there is only one bishop, one episkopos, for each church. And as we've seen for him, that bishop is the definition of the valid celebration of the local assembly. Now, we will look today, after having looked at the Didache, at the apostolic tradition of Hippolytus, which gives us a glimpse of church function in the third century. And here we have Ignatius' threefold ministry, but explicated in much more detail. As we'll see, it includes a ritual of ordination, and it is made clear that the bishop alone is empowered to ordain clergy through the laying on of hands. As we see, this is a kind of a clear development from the earlier encouragement of the Didache to the local church, which is to appoint your own local overseers, bishops, and deacons, to the doctrine of apostolic succession of Clement of Rome, who saw that the bishops were the successors of the apostles, envisioned as being their successors, and therefore instituted by them, but bearing in mind that for him, these bishops are also regarded as elders, described as a presbyteroi. Then Ignatius, not an explicit description of apostolic succession, but a clear distinction between separate orders. And now we have in Hippolytus a clear description of a practice of ordination with the bishop responsible for doing that, and indeed the ordination of a bishop requiring the presence of other bishops. The local church requires representatives of the more universal church in order for the bishop to be properly ordained. There's also a distinction, a clear distinction, as we'll see in Hippolytus, between the elders, the presbyteroi, who to some extent share the clerical state of the bishop. They are permitted to impose hands on other presbyters when they are ordained, but it's made clear that this does not mean that they are ordaining. They are, as it were, proclaiming the common ministry of the presbyters when they do this. And this is, of course, a ritual that's been revived in the Roman Catholic ritual of ordination in relatively modern times. At the ordination of a deacon, however, the bishop alone imposes hands and other deacons do not impose hands. So there is a clear sharing of the clerical state between bishop and presbyter, which is not shared in the same way by the deacons. That is, it seems to be well established by this time that the presbyteroi, the presbyters, may be delegated by the bishop to represent him at local celebrations in a way that deacons may not do. So there is an even clearer distinction of levels of leadership among the clergy. If we then, as we will, look at the apostolic constitutions, which is an anonymous and pseudonymous document, it is attributed, as many documents from this early period of the church are, to the apostles, that is to say, claiming for itself a kind of an apostolic validity, a sense of textual apostolic tradition, a sense that this is a continuation of what the apostles intended. And in this document, we'll even see that in an almost amusing way, different church orders, different practices are assigned to different apostles. This isn't to be taken seriously, but it's a reminder of the desire to see the church in continuity with the earlier tradition. This document is imprecisely dated to somewhere around the middle or perhaps the latter half of the 4th century of the 300s, and as we'll see, to the clear threefold clerical orders of monarchical bishop, presbyteroi, or assisting elders who may be delegated to represent the bishop in certain circumstances, especially at the Eucharistic celebration, and then the deacons who have their own particular function of service. To these three orders, there are now added the additional ministries of deaconess, women who assist at the baptismal liturgies, which are performed by the bishop. The deaconess does not baptize, as we'll see. She assists to preserve good order, especially since the rite of baptism entailed nakedness upon entry into the font. Then also the ministries of subdeacon, those who assist the deacon, of lector, those who read in the church, and of exorcist, following on the ancient ministry of those who were involved in the ministry of healing, and widow, a ministry which we will already have seen hinted at, present in earlier documents. One finds it even in sub-apostolic times in the later epistles, women who are living ministries of prayer and service, women whose husbands have died, but also virgins, unmarried women, who can, under certain circumstances, be permitted to join them. This is the real origin of religious orders or religious communities within the church, which represents a continuity with apostolic times, which women's communities have and men's communities do not. Men's communities will regard themselves as beginning more formally with the example of Antony of the Desert and, to some lesser extent, St. Paul the Hermit, and then St. Pachomius, who establishes a community in Syria, or describe, not in Syria, but in Egypt. St. Pacomius' first attempts at community life will be paralleled by the so-called Daughters and Sons of the Covenant in Syria, who represent service communities of the celibate who existed in those churches certainly since the 3rd century, since the 200s. But in general, one can say that the orders of widows and virgins represent a very great antiquity for women's communities, which is not well documented, not well understood, which men's communities do not have. The committed communities of celibate men are a later development in Christianity, whereas those communities of women probably represent a continuity of one sort or another that existed perhaps even from apostolic times.